This is Daniel Lelchuk telling you that this episode number 125 will be the last before we break for the holidays. But not to worry, we'll be back shortly. In fact, next month, with the cliche-free, substantive conversations with incredible people to which you've become accustomed. Don't forget to give this podcast a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple, and tell your friends on social media about it. They might very well like the show just as much as you do. Have a great holiday season, and be well, and remember, the conversation is just getting started. On today's program, a return appearance by Heidi Heitkamp. She was United States Senator from North Dakota from 2013 until 2019. First woman to be elected to the Senate from that state. Prior to that, she was tax commissioner and attorney general of North Dakota. While in the Senate, she became known for her intense work with lawmakers from both sides of the aisle. Throughout her career, she's courageously fought for the rights of Native Americans and the young people of this country. The first bill she introduced in the Senate, which became law in 2016, created a commission on Native children. Her bill with former Senator John McCain also became law to create Amber Alerts in Indian Country. Since leaving the U.S. Senate, she has continued to focus on the needs of rural voters around this country and began the organization One Country Project with Joe Donnelly, the former senator from Indiana. One Country Project is dedicated to reopening the dialogue with rural communities, rebuilding trust and respect, and advancing an opportunity agenda for rural Americans. With midterm elections looming, how does this veteran of the Democrats see her party's odds of survival come November 2022? What are the Democrats doing or not doing, particularly in rural America, to ensure a viable path in the next elections? Well, Senator Heidi Heitkamp joins me now. I'm thrilled to have her back. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where do the Democrats stand? Are you getting through on the rural front?
The first thing that I'd like to say is the difficulty for, plus 5 or minus 10 districts. By that, I mean plus 5 Democrats or minus 10 Democrats, that range of 15. You can outperform the favorability of your party leader, but only to some extent. When I ran in 2012, this is interesting. I ran in 2012, Barack Obama was on the ballot, was not popular in North Dakota. And so we did polling, and at the end we did daily tracks. And what the daily tracks showed us is that if Barack Obama won by or lost by more than 22 points, I couldn't win. And so in North Dakota, Barack Obama won by 22 and I won by 3,000 votes. The first thing I want to say is how difficult it is to win in a state when the party leader is not popular, when the favorabilities are as low. And that's why you saw the midterm for the former President Trump. That's why you saw the midterm swing in the Congress for the Democrats. He was enormously unpopular. People ran as Republicans in districts that could have gone either way. And his unpopularity added to the defeat of incumbents, but also the ability in open districts for Democrats to win. And so, now we're in the same situation they were in 18. And you have to look at what the presidential favorabilities are, because whether we like it or not, Tip O'Neill is no longer right. All politics are no longer local. They have become nationalized, especially as it relates to people running for Congress or people running for the United States Senate. And so we've got it that the first thing Democrats have to do and the administration has to do is get Biden's favorabilities within 5 points. And right now, you look at averages, he's underwater about 10 points. If he can come up to, close to even or even just a little bit, I think the Democrats can do pretty well in the midterms. And I run counter to what a lot of people will say, because if you remember in 2020, when Biden won, there was a whole lot of, Biden won, But we lost a tremendous number of seats in the House of Representatives. And what I would say about that is that a lot of the seats that we would have lost in a typical midterm, we lost already. And there's an opportunity to win some of those seats back. So I think that you've got to look at overall getting the president's favorabilities up, getting a clear and concise message about what Democrats want to do. And then the third thing I would say is Democrats have to listen. And they have to listen not with a cynical eye towards when people say, look, you know, when you say defund the police, that's not going to work in my district. You can talk about judicial reform, criminal justice reform. You can talk about reforming the police department, but you can't say defund the police because language matters. And so we get into this kind of burden of culture wars. And the confusion people have now is, look, the Democratic agenda is popular, but Democrats aren't popular. I want to say because they don't message that agenda. They message a more cultural agenda. And that cultural agenda isn't always something that is understood or appreciated in more conservative parts of the country.
Well, I want to come to the messaging and the what James Carville says, just the continuous disastrous messaging of the Democrats. But let's stick on the approval rating of Biden for a minute. So let's say now it's around hovering in the low 40s. You know, from a purely political point of view, I mean, you look at some of the things he's done that should have been wildly popular, getting out of Afghanistan, ending that war, America's longest running war, the infrastructure bill. I mean, there's major things that the COVID relief that should have helped him. And no matter what success he has policy-wise, he seems to continue to tumble. What is that about politically?
Well, it's about the appearance of competence. So Afghanistan, yeah, wildly popular to get out of Afghanistan. But then people saw what happened and they go, well, that didn't work out the way it should have worked out. We should have gotten out, but that didn't look so good. And you promised us that you were going to be competent in foreign affairs. And then you look at the infrastructure bill, the big mistake, that the single biggest mistake the Democrats have made legislatively, message-wise, is when the Senate passed that infrastructure bill in a bipartisan way, they should have taken a week in the House. They should have put it on the ballot in the House. And they should have passed it in the House because that builds momentum. Then you look competent. You look like you're governing. Instead, it took the Virginia election and a lot of panic before it happened. And so you lost the momentum of that bipartisan win in the Senate. And now you're another 4 months out from implementation. So you can talk about what it's going to do, but people don't see it on the ground. And so in terms of mistakes, to me, that was the biggest mistake. So yes, the infrastructure bill is popular, but you lost a lot of the political bounce you would get from it by how it was passed.
And the fact that we always heard about numbers, numbers, numbers versus what those numbers represented. Who can process what $500 billion for X means? But but if you're told actually this means that mommy is going to be able to find a place for little Timmy to go safely while she earns a living wage, I mean, that might have sold a little more and said it was only numbers, numbers, numbers.
Well, it's worse than that, actually. What I would say is we spent a whole year with Democrat on Democrat violence. So it shouldn't have been, look what mommy can get. It should have been, why doesn't Ron Johnson over in Wisconsin want you to get help with your daycare bill? You know, instead it's like, well, that Joe Manchin, he's stopping everything. I'm going to say there's 50 United States senators on the other side who are stopping everything too. They should be the target. And so you message based on who your opposition is. And elections are comparisons. Joe Biden, ironically, because of how he's governing, he said, we don't have to beat the almighty. We just have to beat the opposition. It's absolutely the truth. I mean, we set the measurement too high in terms of what we could accomplish. And then when it didn't get accomplished, we then started arguing amongst ourselves as opposed to drawing the contrast with the opposition. I mean, this is a huge message problem that we have, that we can't, that we can't get out of this. You know, the progressives are mad at two United States senators, or the progressives are mad at, you know, so-and-so because they aren't doing this, as opposed to, you know, why don't you go and do a call in to Ron Johnson's office on the human infrastructure package and say, we need help with daycare. If you want us to get back to work, we need help with daycare. And oh, by the way, you know, pre-kindergarten is pretty darn important for a lot of especially lower income kids who need a greater head start. We know that the head start programs work to reduce poverty and to reduce crime. That's why we have groups of law enforcement officials who are arguing for more money for support for Head Start. And so, you know, this idea that we have to draw the contrast within the Democratic Party, the contrast has to be drawn with the Republicans. And ironically, the Republicans know it. And you know why I know that? Because they aren't even going to submit an agenda, right? Because they know their agenda, if they go to the middle, it will anger their right wing. And if they go to the right, it will expose what they really want to do with government. They don't want to govern. They simply want power.
You know, I had Chris Matthews on here a couple of months back when he released a book. And he said, you know, in the old days when he was working in the Senate, it was who could out-politico the other party, who could outsmart, who could come up with better dirty politics tricks to outdo the other side. Now it's simply... No, he said that there's no engagement, there's no cleverness, forget that, there's no inventiveness. It's simply making the other side look bad. That's it.
Well, the Republican Party, I mean, the Democratic Party has plenty of ideology and plenty of ideas and plenty. I mean, give us credit. We're actually trying to say what we're going to do for the people of this country. The Republican Party, from Donald Trump on down, and Mitch McConnell, they aren't about governing. They're about political opportunity. And we've got to expose that like nothing else. But we won't expose it if we continue to basically argue amongst ourselves.
You know,
or between ourselves. I'm not sure. Is it between or amongst?
but either will work for now.
I'll given our last president, I shouldn't be worried about the grammar, should I?
Probably not. I'll do a little research and okay. dig into the real answer, though. You know Mitch McConnell personally. I mean, you worked right with him. I mean, for better or for worse, you know. What is his modus operandi? I mean, how does he?
His modus operandi is to become the majority leader again. He's got the court that he wants, and we saw with the Mississippi case that it's leading to the decisions he wants. And, you know, he will forever, if you asked him what his legislative agenda would be, he would say it's the Supreme Court. Other than that, he has no legislative agenda. He's an opportunist. This is not a guy who wants to govern. This is a guy who wants to be in power. And those are two different things.
Let's talk rural America. You have an expertise in rural America. You're from rural America, as am I, by the way. I grew up in rural New Hampshire. There's a lot of myths about rural America that I think people need to hear. I think people need to have some things dispelled. Not all rural Americans are white. Not all are poor. There's a whole list of things. You were talking recently with Mike Espy about rural America and dispelling some myths. Why don't you do a little of that here for us?
Well, I think, first off, if you look at the last census, rural America is losing population. And the places it's gaining population, they're gaining population because they're embracing diversity. And so when you look at the challenges of rural America, the challenges is, can rural America culturally accept the demographic changes that are inevitable in America? And if they can't survive. But you can't, you know, this is what I tell people. They say, well, you know, look at the reaction to raising issues of racial equality in rural America. And I said, I think most people that I know in rural America would never abide slavery. They are not racist. They are not evil people. But what they hear when people talk about white privilege, they hear somehow they've gotten something they didn't earn. And that seems really unfair to them. And so we need to talk about these social justice issues in a way that is not accusatory. That is more opening a dialogue about their life experience and then listen to a rural American's life experience.
But is it too late for that already? I mean, that train, the non-condescending, the non-guilt-shaming train, that seems to have passed, I don't know, 2 years ago.
If that's true, my work is for nothing, because the single reason why the Democrats have lost rural America is because rural America doesn't think that Democrats respect them or appreciate or know them.
Exactly. Now, is the damage done, or can it be reversed?
Oh, I think it can be reversed. You aren't going to convince everybody, but you can convince enough people to make a difference electorally and to build a base that you can build on to grow a unified country. I mean, people in this country spend a lot of time looking at the haves and haves not, right? The income inequality and wealth inequality. They look at racial inequality and they look at, you know, kind of divide the country black and white or minority and white, divide the country rich and poor or middle class in the middle, divide the country according to all of these other kinds of differences that people have. And the division that I'm trying to get at is a regional division, dividing the country urban-rural. Because when you do that, and when urban America becomes a reliable Republican voting bloc, number one, that's bad demographically for Democrats, but it's bad for rural America. At some point, people are going to ask the question you just asked. Hasn't that train left the station, and why should you bother? And then, depending upon who's in power, do you have any ability to get things done for rural America? And I think when you look at what Joe Biden's done in rural America with Build Back Better and what the other human infrastructure plan, if it passes, would mean for prosperity and opportunity in rural America, these are all pretty popular programs. And certainly the Farm Bill, which is a huge expenditure of federal fisc, is enormously popular in rural America. And so, you know, this idea that you can't win back hearts and minds, but you've got to have a showing of respect. What I was going to say is you can't just look at the Democrats. 57% in our poll of people in rural America say Democrats don't even understand what their life is. Okay, so that's not a good number. But in the flip side, 50% of them say Republicans don't understand their lifestyle. And so who gets out? The Republicans have basically been able to do this work on cultural grounds. I mean, they haven't been any friend on improving the economics of rural America. They've gone along with things like the Farm Bill and rural development, and rural electrification is a Democratic idea. I mean, you just go back historically and say who's kept rural America in business economically, and it clearly is the Democratic Party. And so, you know, but the Republican Party has been able to drive a cultural wedge between urban and rural America. And the one thing, honestly, that is upsetting to me, and it's when rural America says, well, we work hard and people in urban America don't. And I kind of look at them and say, well, I don't know, you know, that guy who's running a small bodega working 20 hours a day keeping his family fed, he's working pretty damn hard. And, you know, so I think there's this idea that somehow one side or the other has some moral superiority or some greater work ethic or some greater love of our country and love of flag. And those are the differences that exacerbate the politics of urban-rural divide.
I think it's so interesting what you say, that there's this sort of competition that some people feel as if they need to prove who loves the country more, who's the better citizen. I mean, to me, a good citizen is someone who cares about the promise of America, who respects America enough to know that we all can each do better, and as a country, we can get better and reach the aspirations laid out in the Constitution.
Well, listen, Daniel, when you go door to door, you're taught, if you've been trained right, not to say who you're voting for, because that's automatically, it's like, number one, it's none of your business. And that's the way rural America would respond. But it's also right away, you're on one side or the other. And so I had a young man I met and when I was teaching at U Chicago, and he said he was taught to ask a question when he went to the door, which is, what kind of America do you want to live in? And he said the answers were remarkably similar. It didn't matter whether you were Democrat or Republican, that people have a pretty good idea of the kind of America they want to live in. And we've got to say, okay, this is the kind of America we want to make sure we pass on to our kids. And this is how we're going to get there. And so I think there's a real opportunity to unite the country around, you know, classic American ideals of opportunity, of equality, of hard work and commitment to flag and country. And I think because Democrats somehow are shy in saying that, I think it leaves an opening for Republicans. And then it's exacerbated by news stations like Fox who say, well, no, there's a war on Christmas. I mean, who's created this war on Christmas? Fox News has created a war on Christmas. There's nobody saying, you know, telling you can't say Merry Christmas in North Dakota. I mean, that just doesn't happen. But yet they find one case where somebody said something once and that becomes the norm. And you see that with high profile politicians. You find one case where somebody says something that really exacerbates the tension in rural America, and then it just gets amplified by these news sources. Now, the problem for the Republican Party right now is they have people like Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene who are shooting off their mouth, making people go, well, I'm not for that either. I mean, that's terrible. So everybody's got their fringe. Unfortunately, the Republicans aren't willing to, I think in Boebert's case, and aren't willing to police their own when people do things that way step over the line of civility.
You know, you mentioned the being united behind flag and sort of a purpose and the greater good. And certainly during World War II, the country was very united. And when we're recording this right now, December 7th is the 80th anniversary of the attacks of Pearl Harbor. I wonder, just as a bit of an aside, if you have any thoughts, any anecdotes or any stories or any pieces of wisdom about Pearl Harbor and how united the country was then, and who knows how it can connect to now, maybe.
Well, you know, it's interesting because before the attack on Pearl Harbor, the country was very divided. And by that, I mean divided on whether they had an obligation to get in this war. North Dakota is famously isolationist. The Nye Report after World War I came from a senator in North Dakota, Senator Nye. We come from a heritage that's fairly isolationist and, you know, wants to just mind our own business. And that, I mean, you saw the reluctance, even passing things like Lend-Lease was difficult for FDR. So it was that external attack that united the country. We weren't united before that external attack. And now the attack on this country in today's world is internal. And we're really struggling with how do we find common ground for this internal attack, which I think things like Promise Keepers and Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters and all these fringe right wing, you know, that what used to be Posse Comitatus kinds of groups, I think that they have found solace and comfort in the Republican Party. And what used to be a common thing to condemn, whether it was David Duke of the Ku Klux Klan or whether it was the Posse Comitatus, both sides would equally condemn them. We don't see that happening now. So the internal threats, which I think these groups are an internal threat, the internal threats are not uniting this country the way the external threats do.
I'm curious just to talk a bit about going into the messaging that you were alluding to before. Do you think the big problem for Democrats is the way they campaign? I mean, we were talking earlier about, certainly there's a lot of great candidates that Democrats put forward, like Mike Espy from Mississippi, but is it mis and disinformation from the right, or are the Democrats not campaigning well, or is it both? Because as you said, the platforms are popular, so it's not a policy issue necessarily.
You know, probably the best Democratic messenger I've ever seen, you know, outside of Bill Clinton. I think Bill Clinton was a master. was a guy named Byron Dorgan, former senator from North Dakota. And every time he wanted to make a point, he told a story. And the story was about values. The story was about something that we could all nod our head and say, yeah, that's what we want. And the Democrats now have become the party of lecturers. We're going to tell you, you know, the numbers, and we're going to tell you, you know, what this expert said and what that expert said. And we don't tell the story of people and why this matters to people. And I think it's single, other than the fact that we have not appropriately drawn the contrast between the true opposition, which is the Republican Party. I think that when you look at messaging, we are way too intellectual and not enough values based.
So give an example of something. What would Byron Dorgan say now? What kind of a story would he tell?
He would tell a story when people, it's personal to Byron, but he told it in a public setting. So he would, you know, when people said, oh, you know, we need to get rid of all these government employees, they're all lazy and they just sit around. And his mother was killed in a very horrible drunk driving episode. And he would say, you know, the guy who drove the ambulance, he was a public worker, and he sure was important to me. And the guy, you know, the police officers who investigated that, they were very kind, and they sure were important to me. And he would go through a list of who in the government he had helped him and his family. And he'd say, so why are you talking like that about our friends and neighbors? And so right away, there was this connection that people had with, number one, the work that was being done for them. And then this kind of moral question about why are you questioning their value as human beings when they are doing a lot of really important work? And, you know, I remember going to a meeting. We had a horrible, horrible drought in 1987. And Byron and Camp were making the rounds among the farm groups, and they were talking about farm debt and how that was going to basically require foreclosures because people couldn't get crops. And I remember some guy in the back stood up and he said, you know, my neighbor, he took out that loan, and he should suffer the consequences of that loan. I didn't take out that loan. And so why should you forgive his loan? And Byron just took a deep breath and he said, well, you know, the way I look at it is you can have neighbors or you don't have to have neighbors.
That's a great answer.
Think about that. That's a great answer. You know, that sometimes your sense of justice or equality is going to be eclipsed by your sense of humanity and community. And you know, maybe you're on the short end of that, but you want to have neighbors. And so I think when you have somebody who can message that way, when you have somebody who can really bring it down to a composite of values, and I mean, I don't want to say warm fuzzy, but you know, who are we as a people, and who do we want to be as a people, and what makes us, you know, unique as a country? And I had to laugh during the pandemic. We ran a bunch of ads in North Dakota saying, you know, in North Dakota we care about each other. And I looked around and I said, well, you know, we got the lowest rate of vaccination. We got the lowest rate of max. And we got a bunch of fights at the school board, and it didn't look that way to me. It looked like, you know, and so there's this persona, but we need about what our values are, but we need to define what actions should be associated with those values. And that's what the Democratic Party doesn't do.
Did you spend a lot of time in the pandemic in North Dakota? In you live in a rural town still, yeah?
Yeah, I live in Mandan, but you know, I'd spent a lot of it in the town I grew up in, Hankinson, North Dakota, which is south of Fargo, a town of, well, I didn't grow up there. I went to high school there. I grew up in a town of 90 people. And I always said, you know, in every small town in North Dakota, there's a coffee shop where people would get together and they would, you know, hammer out the issues of the day. And I said, and, you know, there was always political talk. And there was usually a Democrat who would defend Democratic principles, more Republicans than Democrats. But you at least heard the other side. Now it's crickets. number one, we've lost that kind of community because we don't have the phase anymore. And people just regurgitate what they see on Facebook, which is coming from, who knows, potentially the Russians, right? And so we don't have that neighbor-to-neighbor contact anymore. But I said, in those same small towns, they would have these horrific fights at the coffee shop. And then they would end it by saying, well, are you going to be around tomorrow with the loader on your tractor? Because we want to get the Christmas lights on the tree. And then we should get down to the church and chop down a couple trees and get them into the church for Sunday Mass for Christmas. And, you know, or if the cemetery needed mowing, are you going to go out and mow the cemetery, or who's mowing the ballpark this week? You know, yeah. And so the community learned how to functions to make the community work, regardless of politics. And now we're so angry, and I don't fault Donald Trump for the erosion of democratic support in rural America. I do fault Donald Trump for, number one, inviting in these horrible right-wing extremists into the Republican Party and legitimizing them and darkening and hardening the coarseness of our civil dialogue. I think that, if I can use the euphemism, let's go Brandon, I don't think that would have ever been something that got chanted without Donald Trump telling people it's okay for 4 years to use that kind of language.
I'm Anton over there in North Dakota. Obviously, everybody knows who you are. Do you ever, I guess it's pretty cold there right now, but do you ever put on a big, big coat and a hat and gloves and walk down the street and chat with people? And I mean, is that something that, I mean, you're not running right now for office, but I mean, are you curious to hear what they have to say, or are you, do you basically have a prediction?
I would love to tell you that I'm doing that. I think that at this point, The Great Plains have really gotten to be very, very tough. If I lived maybe in the South, in Georgia, or even Alabama, you know, I think that when you look at where there is a greater opening for dialogue, I'm not convinced it's in the Great Plains anymore.
And even with someone as sort of palatable and likable and familiar as you, I mean, this isn't, you know, it's not AOC marching into Mandan, but even someone like you, you think...
Oh, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Because now we're all AOC. No, I mean, every Democrat's AOC. It doesn't matter if... I mean, think about this. I thought when I ran for re-election that what I had to do is deliver. And I mean, I could give you accomplishment after accomplishment, things that we were able to get done. None of that mattered. Amy Waters, who now owns the Cook Report, she came up to me. She came out for the campaign in 18, and she was talking to a very prominent ag leader in North Dakota. And she asked him about me, and he said, oh, we love her. We love coming to Washington and talk to her. We gave her a national award. She worked so hard for us. And he goes, she said, well, you're going to vote for her? He said, well, no, she's a Democrat. So that's the other thing that's happened. You aren't rewarded for accomplishments, and you're not punished for non-accomplishments. People are voting for the label.
And that's stuck how it is.
That's stuck how it is now. I will tell you what the hope is and where the optimism is. Millennials and the generations below them are not that party loyal. Plus, they're more diverse. They're more sophisticated in a lot of ways in terms of how they're thinking. I'm not saying there aren't young people. I mean, if you look at the insurrection, you saw a lot of very young people marching that day. But I think for the most part, that's where our hope is. It's not in our generation anymore. I think that that's become so hardened. I think it's in engaging and inviting younger people to the debate, and younger people who are more open, not the Josh Hawleys of the world, but the, the Abigail Spanglers.
Yeah. Speaking of young people, are there young talented people, especially in the Midwest or I guess not, maybe not in the Great Plains, but in the Midwest or anywhere in the country who you really like? Abigail Spanberger, maybe one, other people who you see maybe rising stars, or not even stars, rising figures.
You know, it's interesting. I think that the That's another problem with the Democratic Party. When they look at, well, who are we going to run? They go, well, that person once upon a time won something, so let's bring them back out. And I'm like, you know, why aren't we supporting a younger generation of people in down ballot places, whether it's state auditors or attorneys general, or, you know, really giving them a chance to show that they can govern and lead and build the base from the bottom up? Way too often we say, well, that's all the money that goes into politics. Not all of it, but, you know, that the vast majority goes to the Senate or the president. That's not how we build back the party. It's not how we build back an opportunity to win in places like Mississippi and Alabama and North Dakota and Montana.
You know, everybody on this program talks a little bit about music because I think it's the great unifier. I remember you and I spoke about music. You mentioned Amy Winehouse last time we spoke, but you might be listening to something different now. And of course, as it gets colder, you're going to be inside more, maybe go to your Spotify or YouTube or something. So what's on your musical plate these days?
Well, it's Christmas music.
Good.
Dean Crosby. Dean Martin. I think Dean Martin everybody's like Frank Sinatra. I'm like, forget Frank Sinatra. Give me Dean Martin any day. I love Dean Martin. I think he's got just such an amazing voice. And, you know, obviously, you know, looking at Christmas music and you know, that's a great unifier too. Keep politics out of Christmas. Unfortunately, it's become a cause for the right wing to say Democrats don't believe in Christmas. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? You know, come see my brother's house, man. You can't find a square inch where there isn't, you know, Christmas in that house. And the other piece of music is that it reignites what is emotional for us, what really connects. And I don't think there's any genre of music that does it quite as well as country music. I was listening to a bunch of country music the other day thinking this all kinds of sounds alike and it's not as engaging. And then you listen to just one or two of the stories that are told by these artists and you're amazed. You know, one of my great experiences in the last couple weeks has been, I was in Nashville for a hockey game and we went to something called the Listening Room. And there's a group of women singer-songwriters in Nashville who felt like they weren't being given a chance. And so, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, they formed something called Song Suffragettes. And every Monday at the Listening Room, they bring in some old standards that everybody knows and some new talent, and they all take turns singing some of their songs. And I just had to smile. Some of them were just so real and so engaging. And, you know, I don't know what the politics were of anybody in that room, but we were all enjoying the same music and enjoying the same storytelling that happens in country music.
Country music is a very approachable, I find, very evocative. I don't know anything about it, and I'm not from a sort of country background in that sense, but I like it a lot. You know, I know Schubert and Mozart and Beethoven and all those guys more than anything else, but I agree. There's something just great to it. And,
you know, Ken Burns did that great great documentary series on PBS on country music. Everybody should watch it. But the one thing that I would say, if people are asking for a recommendation, go out. Last year, when they were still in kind of the pandemic, Garth Brooks got the Kennedy Center honor and the first American Idol.
Oh,
Kelly,
yeah.
Kelly Clarkson sang Miss the Dance. Oh my God, just watch it. I mean, you know, the dance, what a story and what a line, you know. I'd rather not have the pain, but I would have had to miss the dance.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, and I don't know when she sang it, and he sings it beautifully too, but she's so amazing. I think she's an amazing artist. It was interesting. She performed at the second inaugural for Obama, and Beyonce also performed, and I'm not I think she lip-sank hers, Beyonce did. Kelly Clarkson got up there And I don't know, other than Aretha Franklin, and I've seen her perform on that in that setting, other than Aretha Franklin, I don't know that I have seen anyone perform with the passion and the quality of Kelly Clarkson. She's way underrated as an artist, I think. Not underrated, because obviously she's very popular, but I think she's enormously talented. I think she's a force to be reckoned with on many levels. But go out, just it's on YouTube. Watch her performance of that classic.
I'm going to do it as soon as we get off this call. We're coming into the new year, coming into 2022. And you're busy with One Country Project, which is your organization working to connect with rural Americans and listen. And I think you have a good understanding of what rural America is all about, but maybe not every Democrat does. Do the Democrats need to go out, hold kit and caboodle, bang the pots and pans, or rather listening with the ear trumpet, so to speak, in rural America, that put their eardrum right onto the ground and get a feel for what's going on?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in some ways they can do it. Obviously that takes time and it's really tough to travel when you've got a busy legislative agenda. But, you know, in rural America, drive radio is still critical. There's other avenues that you can connect with people, you know, Facebook. I mean, so this idea of it's remote and we can't get there. Well, stop that. There's a lot of things you could be doing that could make a difference. You know, now that people are zooming into regional television. I mean, I did television all over the country for Biden in 2020, you know, in local radio, local TV stations, you know, as a surrogate. And so you can talk about the agenda. You can, you know, and hopefully get some tough answers. Join some panels. Every state who has a PBS station, as far as I know, has a political talk show. You know, get on the political talk show. Join it by Zoom. You don't need to be there in person. That's one thing we've learned from the pandemic. But at least it'll be an audience that you don't typically, that doesn't typically hear what's going on in the administration. And you've got to get surrogates on the ground. And the frustration I've had is the lack of appointments into critical USDA and particular positions on the ground that could speak for the Biden administration and what's happening in Biden policies. But there's no one out here.
You're such a great communicator, such a natural storyteller, probably like some of your mentors that you alluded to. And you also have a lot of energy. So obviously one wonders, yes, you're on TV a lot, and that's great. And you do a wonderful podcast, Hot Dish, and you're at these great universities working with students. But the calling of politics, is it still there? Will you run again for something?
No.
No.
Mm-mm. No. I mean, I'm 66 this year. And, you know, and I will never leave. North Dakota will be my residence. And I live here. I own two houses in North Dakota. And, you know, this is where I'm going to, complete my life. And North Dakota is not a place where I could, I mean, I used to win in North Dakota by 60%. I mean, I won races by 64, 65%. I don't think I could get more than 45 even today.
And you didn't make it.
I think it's just, I think that
radically left.
Until we change the Democratic brand substantially in terms of, you know, I don't say we have to change Democratic values, but we have to message the brand different.
Well,
differently.
You are.
There's another grammatical.
Differently. Oh, that's right.
Yeah. And that's the other thing, the lack of grammar. You know, the former president just this week put out a statement that had a double negative. I don't know that he even knows, Mr. Genius, you know, he's a genius. I don't even know if he knows that a double negative means a positive. I mean, you know, and they say, well, that's nitpicking. And I want to say, no, these rules are there for a reason, to communicate what you actually mean.
Well, if that were the biggest of his problems, that would be nice, yeah. But I'm not sure it is.
Well, it's not. And picking on him only gets eye rolls from the right. And I get it. But by the same token, if you went back to the 1950s and people in the 1950s could be watching what's going on right now, whether it is, you know, don't cuss in public, you know, be nice to each other, even though you disagree, you know, that that there was punishment, political punishment for certain behaviors, hypocrisy, being inconsistent, you know, and that that punishment, political punishment, isn't there anymore. And I think that's a pretty significant challenge that we have moving forward, that the norms and standards that we all accepted as politicians, that you can't flip-flop, you gotta be honest, you can't lie, that's all been turned upside down by the former president.
Do you ever swear?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I try not to do it in public. Well, I just use the light. That I mean, you know, the non really objectionable.
You mean you say dang instead of damn?
No, I might say damn, but I might call someone an ass.
I see.
But that's like calling him a donkey, right?
Well, you know, next time you come back, I hope there's a next time. You're welcome to use all the colorful language you want. No problem.
I'll try not to.
Senator Heidi Heitkamp, I can't thank you enough. There's a lot to think about here. I hope people will listen. I think your quote, "We are all AOC," I think that's going to ring very, very deeply with a lot of people, and maybe not in a great way. But you tell it like it is. You tell it like you see it. I can't thank you enough.
You bet. Take care. And I hope you're on the road. Giving your gift of music to so many people in this country. That's so important right now.
You've been listening to Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk. The original theme music is by Ronald Barkham. The content coordinator is Nathaniel Mosse, and Doug Christian is executive producer. We invite you to subscribe and leave a 5-star review on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can support us at patreon.com/talkingbeats. That's patreon.com/talkingbeats. And be sure to check us out on social media. We'll see you next time on Talking Beats with Daniel Elchuk.